Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, this is Jason Greenblatt on The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek. Today, I'm pleased to interview Benham Bentaliblou. Benham is a senior fellow at FDD, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Benham co-authored a piece with Saeed Gassaminejad. They wrote this piece for The National Interest. The piece is entitled, How Biden Can Stand with the Iranian People. A lot of protests going on in Iran. Very, very little news coverage about it. Key line to me is with the prospect of reform of the Iranian regime, the murderous Iranian regime non-existent. The Iranian protests offer Washington a chance to do well by doing good. Take a listen to Benham and hear his thoughts about what's going on in Iran. He gives a little bit of history at the beginning. We talk about the protests and what the Biden administration and frankly the rest of the world can and should do. I'm Jason Greenblatt. This is The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek. As I mentioned, I'm here with Benham Bentaliblou. Benham, thank you. Thank you for joining me. I read your piece in The National Interest entitled How Biden Can Stand with the Iranian People. I think it's such an important piece. It's such an important topic today that's getting so little coverage, and we'll get to that in a minute. Before we get to that and to talk about what you wrote and your many ideas, let's talk about the background, not only to this protest and why this protest cropped up and how it's going, but let's take the listeners back. Let's assume for a minute that many of my listeners don't even understand what's going on in Iran with the Iranian regime for all these years. Give them a recap of what the people of Iran have been facing.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, Jason. Thank you for the very kind invite. I do agree very strongly with what you said, that not only are these Iran protests not getting enough coverage, but the world, and in particular the West, is not doing enough to put its money where its mouth is on the Iran human rights file. And I think that's not only a political or a moral setback, that's a strategic setback too, given the outside security threats that the Islamic Republic poses, and the opportunity to really realign America's head and America's heart in the Middle East, a place you seldom, perhaps outside of Israel or one or two other places, you seldom get a chance to do this. So in essence, there has been an Islamic Republic in Iran for 43 years. It came into power February 11, 1979. And almost as long as there's been an Islamic Republic, there have been protests against it. Yes, the regime did come to power via the streets. Many say it was a co-opted revolution. Many see it as a coup, actually. There's a long history there. But suffice to say that there's always been a portion of the Iranian population that did not agree with that government. And the government used foreign and domestic crises over the past 4+ decades to constantly narrow the already narrow spectrum for politics and society in that country, and reveal itself quite quickly to become the ultra-hardline, ultra-Islamist, ultra-authoritarian regime that we now know it to be. The country's had two supreme leaders, one the founding father of that Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, who many of your listeners may know from the hostage crisis and his decade at the helm in the 1980s. And then the second one, Ayatollah Khamenei, who's been there and apparently is the Middle East's longest running dictator to date. And he's basically continued to narrow that political spectrum, continued to crush violently and with lethal force various iterations of national protests. And the protests that we're seeing now, the protests that we are seeing triggered by the brutal killing of this Iranian Kurdish woman, Mahsa Amini, 22-year-old, basically killed violently, brutally beaten by the morality police, died after a coma. And the protests have been going on in that country for 3+ weeks now since her death was revealed on September 16th. Those protests did not come out of a social vacuum, shall we say. the chasm between state and society in Iran has been growing for those past four decades. But they've been growing on steroids since the failure of the Green Movement, or the failure of the movement after the stolen presidential election, or stolen presidential selection, some would say, in 2009, that led to that thing called the Green Movement. And I'm sorry to give so much history here, but there really was a time when some Iranians, particularly in the late 90s, tried to move that country's politics towards reform. But what many Iranians have seen and lived through is not only the failed experiment of reform, but the inability of this system to reform itself. So in the decade between 2009 and 2017, you saw many, many labor strikes lay the predicate for what you saw very openly since 2017. And these protests that were touched off on September 16 and continue today build on not the pro-reform protests from 1999 and 2009, but the directly anti-regime, meaning against the regime in its entirety, not one element of the system against the other, not in favor of one politician or against another, but a wholesale pushing away from the table against this regime. So since 2015, it can be empirically said that Iranians, particularly urban and rural poor, but a much wider demographic and geographic spread than many political scientists and social scientists and Iran watchers and analysts and activists had previously assumed, were ready to come out, be public, grab that third rail, and say quite literally in their slogans that they're done with the Islamic Republic. And what you've seen, these different iterations of national protest from 2017 to present do, is use every available opportunity, be it an economic grievance. You know, the 2017 one started over the high egg prices in late December 2017. That rolled across 2018 into a bunch of other economic crises, merged with social and political issues such as the veil issue. The veil issue is not new. Iranian women have been protesting very bravely for many years against the mandatory and discriminatory hijab that they have to wear, which is imposed on them in the country's penal code. And the morality police do enforce those with force. And the morality police actually does have men and women enforcing these with force. But you've also seen environmental issues rise up. You've also seen foreign insecurity policy issues rise up. Food prices rise up. You know, after the flooding in Iran in 2018-19, there were significant protests. After the downing of the Ukraine airliner, you may remember, in January 2020, there were significant protests. And perhaps most widespread, in November 2019, 1,500 Iranians were killed using weapons of war by this regime in a matter of days, hiding under the cover of a 6 or 7 day internet blackout in what Iranians call the Aban, or the November protests. And those protests were triggered by high oil prices and, you know, oil subsidy cuts at the pump at home. And what many in the West have mistakenly done is read the trigger as the thing that sustains the movement. They see a protest triggered by high food prices or high oil prices as merely an economic protest. And some have even seen this as merely a women's rights protest or about gender. No, this entire ordeal we've been seeing since 2017 is convulsing Iranian society, and is precisely why the regime is responding so overtly and with increasing levels of violence over time. These are protests from the street against the state, saying they are done with this regime in its entirety. And that is a damning proposition for a regime which has already tried to use brute force to suppress different iterations of the protests over time. And all that ended up doing was underwriting the next batch of protests. These protests can be directly tied to protests that we saw in May of this year, where, again, high food prices and cuts to food subsidies led to several days of protests driven by the same demographics, urban and rural poor, and then moving in towards the center. And again, time will tell if the Biden administration does change its policy. It's improved somewhat since the Obama years of 2009. It rhetorically embraced the protesters, is very wise, prudently, strategically, morally, and ethically to mention them, as President Biden did at the UNGA. But again, now is the time to put more meat on the bone. We just had some more human rights designations come up from the Treasury Department. You've had the Canadian step up pressure. The Europeans are looking to engage in human rights sanctions, potentially maybe as early as mid to late October. I think every country with autonomous sanctions capabilities should be stepping up here, because now is the time to really show what it means when you stand with the Iranian people. And speaking of that, as a final corollary, I'm sorry this went very long, that piece you mentioned is actually co-authored by a partner in crime of mine, Dr. Syed Qasem-Nejad at FDD. And he's a fascinating guy. He's a trained financial economist. But in Iran, he was party to some of the earlier iterations of protests. And he too has a great story because he is someone who's been able to live out his dreams. He was an activist before. He actually went to Evin prison and survived and has been really leading on many of these financial sanctions and human rights and political issues at the organization. And, you know, me who comes at this issue from the foreign and security policy and the security lens, merging up with him, over time, we've written a series of pieces from 2017 that we are now are gaining traction that show this evolution away from reform and towards revolution. And that's what I would stress for everyone today, is that the people are done with reform. The regime is not reformable. It is clear that they are on the side of revolution. What is unclear is where is the West and where is the rest?
Well, thank you for the deep background. I think that's going to be of great benefit to my listeners. And you touched on really what I wanted to start from your article and your colleague's article in the National Interest, this line that says, with the prospect of reform non-existent, the Iranian protests offer Washington a chance to do well by doing good. Do they get it? Does Washington understand it? Frankly, it's not just Washington, right? If Washington doesn't have partners in Europe and elsewhere, there's not a lot that Washington can do effectively by itself. But do you think Washington gets it, part one? And part two, why isn't the media covering these protests in any way that's meaningful so people could really see what's going on? I see the sporadic stories and all that. That's true. It's covered in The New York Times, Washington Post. It's true. But it seems to be very thin coverage, which I think is to the detriment of the Iranian people tremendously.
It's also to the detriment of the free press and the press that wants to focus on stories that matter and stories that are really moving and shaking things around the world. I mean, unfortunately, much of that press were part of the same cadre of folks that saw these different iterations of protests since 2017. And again, only focused on the trigger without seeing the root cause, or only focused on what brought the Iranian people onto the streets, but failed to assess what kept them on the streets, or failed to assess why, even though there was lethal force employed time and time again, that lethal force merely laid the predicate for the next national convulsion in a quicker and shorter duration of time. So yes, you know, it is unfortunate they have not received the kind of higher level press coverage. I think the more press coverage they do give, the greater the chance of success for these protesters. I think it was Netan Sharansky, who famously said when he heard, you know, the U.S. President Reagan mentioning his name, that was like an injection or like an emotional boost or something to that effect. I think, you know, the Biden administration in particular, but all governments should be saying the names like Mahsa Amini, Hadis Najafi, and linking it, you know, in the minds of their publics too. This being another like Neda Agha-Sultan in 2009, or people who were killed or abducted under previous iterations of protests, like Navid Afkari or Sattar Beheshti or Pouya Bakhtiari, or even Iranian women who've suffered elsewhere at the hand of this regime, like Zahra Kazemi, the famous Canadian-Iranian photojournalist. There are one too many names, unfortunately, and the public may not know all of their stories. But again, this is do well by doing good, an area where there can be great convergence, great harmony between how we think and how we feel and what's best for us in terms of national interests in this country, and as well as in terms of the larger geostrategic interests of the U.S. and the West and the region. I mean, I just want to stress that seldom do you get a chance to have all these pawns on all these little pegs on the board on the right side. You tend to have to make one sacrifice, move one tick here, move one tack. If again, one is looking at this as a chessboard. But there's more and more players involved in this chessboard. But ironically, that is only strengthening the case to do the morally right thing. You know, this is a regime where one of the slogans was "Nagarbi Nashari Jomhuri Islami," which is neither East nor West Islamic Republic. But what you've seen in the past couple of decades, particularly the last decade and a half, two decades, is that for the Islamic Republic to survive, and for the imperative of ideologically contesting the West, this regime has had to go east. You know, a real, in some ways, sellout of national sovereignty in terms of what the Iranian people see at home to the likes of China and Russia. Authoritarianism and those bastions of authoritarianism is not where the Iranian people see their future is best served. You see it in everything from the commodities that they're forced to settle for versus the nature of the alliances that the regime is engaging in. the fact that there's a widening radius of Iranian drone proliferation to Russia being used in the Ukrainian theater. That is absolutely huge. This is a game changer in terms of that, you know, the arms embargo, which was unfortunately allowed to lapse, in terms of if we have a problem with the regime being able to say no to the West at the negotiating table for so long. One reason they are able to is that China has been the largest licit and illicit importer of Iranian crude oil, you know, from the pre-deal era to the during deal era to the post-deal era. You know, if the regime has been able to survive sanctions pressure, we know who has been buying the amount of oil, underwriting the regime's foreign aggression and domestic repression. There is great linkage here to want to do right by doing good for Washington, and understand not just within the regional context and the counterterrorism context, and obviously to help stand with our partners in Israel and Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in the region, but also to, if you zoom out 50,000 feet and you engage in these high-level geostrategic debates that are going on in Washington about the rise of China and about nuclear deterrence and about countering Putin, Iran still factors in there as well, because there is no universe in which those actors, and if particularly if you add in the Kim regime in North Korea as well, do not draw inferences about American resolve and American staying power and American capabilities and American interests from one theater to another. Everyone watched the very public, highly bungled departure of the U.S. of its longest war in Afghanistan. Everyone is watching the way the U.S. responds to North Korean missile tests currently and nuclear tests in the past. Everyone, every time there's drama in the South China Sea, is looking to see what's been going on. And everyone has been watching in real time what the U.S. response has been vis-a-vis the crisis in Ukraine and the Russian invasion there. And everyone is trying to see if now, after almost a year and a half, 2 years of the Biden administration reaching out its hand, and Iran not only escalating its nuclear program, but escalating in the region. And now, of course, since September 16, cracking down in a violent and brutal and overt way at home. If any of that will be enough to disabuse the Biden administration to close the door on what I think we all know is a fatally flawed deal, or on its best day, a Faustian bargain to resurrect the 2015 nuclear deal. This doesn't mean, of course, that Washington shouldn't have to worry about nuclear nonproliferation. But if those concerns existed pre-protest, now I think is the time to push away from the table in general and say, what will the money that we give this regime to buy even less time on the clock now be used for? And are we comfortable with that? And do we have a policy to respond to that and contain that and counter that and roll that back? And I don't think Washington has thought about that. To be brutally honest with you, I think while there is much of this talk of plan A being pressure and plan B being, you know, or plan A being diplomacy and plan B being potentially pressure out of Washington, I really think the administration pre-protest was gunning for a plan C, which is so long as the regime does not rush to weapons-grade uranium, and so long as the Biden administration is seen as trying, it will never really pull the plug on nuclear talks, because in the philosophy of the administration, pressure is seen as a driver of the Iranian nuclear program rather than a thing with which to handicap the Iranian nuclear program. Unfortunately, gone are the days of, you know, 2010 to 2015, when in the U.S. Congress you had Democrats and Republicans, you know, being able to vote on these resolutions related to Iran 98-1 or 99-0. Unfortunately, it's become a partisan policy proposition. And what is even more unfortunate is that those partisan cleavages are very public, and our adversaries make sense of them, not just in Iran, perhaps on a greater scale in Russia and in China, but even on the Iran scale, zooming in, there is absolutely no reason why Iran's former president, Hassan Rouhani, should be mentioning George Floyd at the UNGA. There is absolutely no reason why the current president, Raisi, should be able to mention January 6th at the UNGA. What the Iranians are trying to do is to paint America as a pariah, and that is projection 101, because this regime is a pariah at home and is a pariah abroad. And I think it's time Washington's Iran policy take that into account.
Yeah. So let's talk about the JCPOA. You know, on the chessboard, using your metaphor, the JCPOA occupies numerous pieces, the really big pieces, right? Tell my listeners, please, why they should understand why it's a bad deal for America, why it's a bad deal for our allies. And you mentioned the U.S. has stretched out its hand to Iran. I'd argue maybe we should say has stretched out its hands to Europe, for Europe to stretch out its hands to Iran rather than our friends and allies in the region, Israel, Saudi, UAE, Bahrain, and others. I am a firm believer that it is us and the Arab countries that should be sitting at a table with Iran. And if Iran's not willing, then we shouldn't be talking at all, because I don't think the Europeans have America's interests at heart at all. I think they only want to make money. So give my listeners a taste for why you think the Biden administration is still hoping to do some sort of deal and what the danger of that deal is.
The hope comes from acting on that Plan C. And it's a thing that started when the Iranian nuclear sites were revealed in 2002, 2003. But ultimately, Iran has had a nuclear program in one shape or another across two very different regimes, both of the drivers of the late Shah, now the current Islamic Republic's nuclear program, remain two outsized things: status concerns and security deliberations. It doesn't mean that they only wanted it for show, and it doesn't mean that they only wanted it for immediate military purposes. There's a political dividend for them and a strategic military dividend for them. And the Ayatollahs actually resurrected the late Shah's program amid an eight-year war that they call the Holy Defense or the Sacred Defense. So if you think that the P on the possible military dimensions is questionable, to me, it's not at all. You know, in this war, you know, everything was basically mobilized. There's even declassified evidence of the regime even reverting to a different kind of WMD, chemical weapons, when it was on the receiving end of chemical attacks for so long. So in terms of this regime's ideology and conceptualization of the threat, a nuclear weapon has, does, and will continue to suit their strategic interests. And there is nothing wrong with attempting to use coercive diplomacy to try to dissuade an adversary or pressure an adversary to curb or cut or roll back their program. But the Biden administration, in my view, subscribes to the idea that was developed and inherited by the Obama administration, which is ultimately that building on the framing of the Iran threat that the Bush administration had when the nuclear issue went so public in 2002, that if Iran is a country with a lot of different threats, the most salient threat or the most urgent threat would be the nuclear threat, because it would magnify all the other threats. And in so doing, it's like a wedding cake. It's like the different layers. You know, you got the regional terrorism, missile, human rights, whatnot, illicit finance, cyber, and then all the way up to that narrow level at the top. But that's the one everyone focuses at the wedding. And that's the one you save for, you know, having next year with the wife on an anniversary. But that isn't the entire architecture of the threat. What buoys it, in my view, the nature of the regime, the capabilities of the threat that have been evolving over time, are what makes that eventuality even more scary. So the over-focus on that, plus the U.S. desire to course correct from what was seen by the Obama administration, it was extra-regional or too many regional entanglements, meant that it was okay to see Iran almost exclusively as a nuclear threat. And in practice, what happened was the sacrificing of dealing with the rest of those threats, which on the most immediate level was most immediately a threat to the countries you mentioned, which is the countries in the region, the countries that are pro-American, Bahrain, UAE, Saudi, Israel, and several others. And they live literally on the front lines of this evolving threat, not even the nuclear threat, but the conventional threat, the asymmetric threat, the terrorism threat, the rest of those threats. The regime has proxies and continues to build proxies that escalate against those countries, that function like a knife increasingly being put, that is sharpened and increasingly being put against the neck of these pro-American forces in the region to force accommodation of the Islamic Republic's views and wishes rather than contestation. And then ultimately, for the regime to be able to deter any attack on its homeland with that ultimate strategic weapon, which is a nuclear weapon. So in the thinking of the Obama administration, it was possible to arrest the growth of that program by changing the parameters of the debate. And in that sense, the parameters were changed from, can Iran have the technology and fuel cycle stuff needed for domestic enrichment, for fissile material, for a nuclear weapon in a capped and monitored way, and moving that from a can question to how much. So a yes or no, a monadic, can they have it, should they have it, versus a how much can they have. And that was in the diplomacy that brought about the interim nuclear deal in 2013 and the final nuclear deal in 2015. That initial concession was brought about in the private channel that, again, many regional countries did not know about, that in fact, the Europeans didn't know about early on, through the U.S. and Iran, in a back channel that was had in Oman during the tail end of the first term of the Obama administration. Biden administration has inherited a lot of that thinking, a lot of that philosophy of the threat. Remember, they believe that pressure drives the program. They don't believe pressure arrests or helps you dealing with the program. And that's why you've seen them only starting this May, and a one-off, one every month since this May, actively enforce the oil penalties, the most significant painful penalties that they had inherited from the previous administration, from the Trump administration. And in fact, they had actively denigrated this capability, this economic tool for the past year and a half, so much so that Iranians would use, they would copy paste sometimes State Department talking points that sanctions don't work or maximum pressure failed. It's a major setback if your adversary is able to take your language in an unadulterated fashion and use it against you. I'm not sure that's something the State Department was aware of, but that is something that has been happening and continues to happen. So ultimately, for the Biden administration, the good news is that they are not making the transformational arguments about the deal that the Obama administration made, that in 10 years' time, Khamenei may die, or in 10 years' time, we need to work to empower the Iranian moderates, or that in 10 years' time, it would be a fundamentally different kind of government. Those arguments are not being made. There is a narrower approach being taken, but that quest for a narrower approach only highlights the fact that everything else is going to be sacrificed on that altar. And that's precisely why me and my colleague Saeed say in this piece that so long as you keep the door open for the JCPOA, which removes secondary sanctions on a whole series of banks and businesses and bad actors that are engaged in non-nuclear threats, you basically are shutting the door in the face of the Iranian people. And that means all the good stuff that we've seen, which in my view is marginal, but you have to, call a spade a spade. This is good, that the increasing rhetoric, the different rounds of human rights designations, socializing some of those designations vis-a-vis the Canadians and hopefully with the Europeans. All of that stuff would be at best ornamental rather than instrumental to the heart of the administration's Iran policy. And it would not represent a course correction. It would not represent a real learning from 2009. And it would not represent a true understanding of what is going on in the Middle East. And it will be driven by a desire to simply be done with the region and see it only as a nuclear threat. But in so doing, it would do exactly what happened to the Obama administration, which is to push away from Iraq, only to have the facts of the ground bring you back in.
If you were sitting in front of President Biden, some of my former colleagues in the White House, State Department, NSC, and you had the ability to pitch them for an elevator pitch, 3 minutes. All right, you and your colleague were kind enough to lay out 10, to me, seemingly great ideas in your piece. If you wanted to say, stop with the JCPOA, close that door now, and here are our best ideas for you to take a look at to see what you could do, what would you tell them?
Well, I would say step one is close the door for the JCPOA, push away from the table publicly on that. Step two is definitely, of course, to keep the names, the issue alive through tweets, press releases, statements. Congress is already doing a great job on both sides of the aisle of this to keep that issue alive there as well. I would also say, of course, now is the time to massively ramp up the human rights designations, both at the minimal level, at the region, at the local level, literally the commanders who are engaging in this repression. You can find the divisions, the regions, the cities, the towns, the provinces, the villages, and identify through the open source who these people are. Engage in those designations, name and shame the Iranian rights violators, and scale that all the way up to include targeting the supreme leader and the president under human rights authorities themselves. It's good news that just recently they went after the Minister of Interior and the Minister of Communications, given the role they played in the crackdown. But it's time to widen that sanctions net. And the strategy that we've offered in the paper is how to do it at the regional and local level and how to do it at the national level. Beyond that is to socialize those designations with every single country that has autonomous sanctions capabilities, in particular countries that have Magnitsky sanctions, but also against in countries that have more general human rights related sanctions regimes. You can multilateralize this through the UN process by looking for a potential resolution at the Human Rights Council, but you should also be naming and shaming places where the Islamic Republic has gotten a pass in the UN, such as for the fact that this spring, this regime was elected. I think it's a blind vote or a secret ballot or something, but nonetheless, this regime was elected to the Commission on the Status of Women when they treat women in this fashion.
I got to interrupt. Isn't that outrageous? I mean, what does it say for the UN that that happened?
It says a lot about the UN, unfortunately. And I mean, you and me, and I think your listeners can go off on more than an elevator pitch tirade there. So forgive me for brushing it off, but it does say a lot about the UN. The next step, of course, is to work on actually enabling the Iranians to communicate better with each other through mobile phones and any kind of software needed there, but also through virtual private networks. And most importantly, with satellite internet. Everyone is talking about this Elon Musk Starlink business. The real question, the outsized question, is hardware. Now is the time to take the best and the brightest public sector, private sector, and create an interagency task force to see how you can actually get this hardware into Iran. It doesn't have to be something on the intelligence side. To what level do businesses and other actors have to be involved? What level of risk can be taken on for the government? What level of risk can be taken on for the private sector? This is something you want the best and brightest on. And I simply don't see enough of that. Beyond that, of course, there's a lot more that can be done. This is the price floor of a fundamentally new approach towards the Islamic Republic. I mean, at the regional level, for instance, Israel, a major U.S. partner, you want to see a stepping up of pressure. You know, in Israel, you have the war between the wars, famously termed the military pushback against the Islamic Republic in the region. Now would be the time to signal that the Islamic Republic is being defeated, not just at home, but in the region. We saw the regime lash out brutally against Kurds in northern Iraq. This is the second time they've actually used ballistic missiles against Kurdish positions in northern Iraq, alleging that those are, you know, Mossad dens or whatnot, or that they're behind the protests more recently in Iran. So really, now is the time to not let the regime try to feign strength abroad as it looks so weak at home. So it's to hold the regime to account. And then lastly, the sanctions that remain on the books, the larger macroeconomic ones related to oil, crude oil, but most importantly now petrochemical, which is an area the regime has diversified and is classified slightly differently in U.S. law, actively enforce those. And through pre-existing precedents that exist and using basically now lawfare as a weapon of war, engage in the asset forfeitures, seize those tankers, and turn the funds that you get from the oil sold from those tankers into an Iran Freedom Fund that could be used to kind of mirror what happened with some of these organizations and strike funds in Poland under Solidarity during the Cold War, or to pay people who have lost lives, who were breadwinners of their family, who are protesters, but basically to get creative. Now is the time for peak creativity. I'm not a particularly creative person. I've been living in Washington for too long. I think I think these 10 ideas we socialize and we kind of talked about, if someone who is as uncreative as me, and this is nothing about my colleague Said, but if someone who is uncreative as me can help come up with them, I'm sure the best and the brightest in the U.S. government, the public sector, can again use that as a stepping stone to think even better and even smarter.
So last two questions, we'll start with the second to last one. You mentioned best and brightest public-private partnership. What's your message to Americans, and frankly, Newsweek has a pretty broad international platform, to really anyone outside of Iran? Why should they care? Why should they put effort into this story to help the people of Iran?
Well, the first is that the Iranian people have been protesting for over a century for representative government. I mean, this is a story where if you really do care about the fate of democracies in a beleaguered world right now, where we have the greater macro narrative of autocracies versus democracies, this is not going to be one of a foreign imposed democracy. This is one where you have continuity, a century-long struggle for dignity, social justice, representative government. And the reason the Iranian people are so fed up is that they are the heirs to that movement. And again, every time one protest is crushed, every time one movement fails, it underwrites the other. The next, of course, is that if you think you can pivot away from the region, or if you think you can be done with this, or if you think all you need to care about for those audiences are macro-level strategic things, we just showed you the great connectivity between the great power competition paradigm and the rising or revisionist power competition paradigm, the linkages between Iran and North Korea on that second tier and Russia and China on that first tier. And many people have said this, I'll say it again, you may be done with the Middle East, but the Middle East is not done with you. When they say death to America, they mean it. When they say death to Israel, they mean it. They are quite literally showing you how they treat their own people. How do you think they will treat others? And again, for the people who live in the region, they've borne the brunt of how they treat others for the past four decades with the export of the revolution policy and the creating of these proxy terror militias that the regime itself calls the axis of resistance. So if you think you are going to secure more peace, not less in the region, just by focusing on the nuclear issue, downplaying coverage of the human rights issue, you have another thing coming. Just recently, a small tangent, strategic regional matter. The ceasefire that was extended in Yemen has unfortunately lapsed. Just last month, there was a huge military parade in Sana'a, where the Houthis are, the capital of Yemen. At least three or four new Iranian missile systems that I've only seen in Iran, who I've seen carbon copies of under new Arabic names in that military parade. Just today, the Houthis threatened Saudi Arabia and Saudi oil installations that if, you know, some of their demands are not met, they would resume those longer range cross-border strikes. So this stuff is not as containable and it's not as easily compartmentalizable. And again, whether you care about regional security, energy, human rights, great power competition, there is an amazing urgent need to see what is happening in Iran now, which is the convergence of all those issues in the street versus state debate and protest going on, not just in Tehran, but having hit every single one of Iran's 31 provinces.
You know, if you want to talk about the Houthi terrorists, right? We're so busy now talking about today's story or yesterday's story about OPEC plus oil prices, which I'm not going to deny it's an important story.
Yeah.
But nobody's talking about the Houthi terrorists either. And the damage that they've caused and the damage they could cause is tremendous. So we think our oil prices are high now. What happens if not?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So let me tag you with the last question now. So reportedly about 133 killed, Iranians killed in this recent series of protests, about 3,000 or so arrested. Brutal, brutal force by the regime against these protesters. The videos that I'm seeing across Twitter are frightening. If any Iranians who are protesting hear this podcast, and I have no way to know if they will or won't, hopefully they have some access to it. What's your message to them?
Listen, first, my hat's off to you for the bravery. You know, I'm an Iranian American. I'm born and raised here in the States. You know, there's this line from Jurassic Park 3, not necessarily a classic film, but there's a dichotomy made between astronomer and astronaut. And I've simply been the astronomer, to borrow a phrase from that film, looking at issues in a country of particular concern to me. It's where generations of my family lived and died. You know, both my parents left Iran, you know, my father before the revolution, my mother after the revolution. They met abroad. They got married abroad. I was born abroad. You know, for many people, this is both the head and the heart. And I'm lucky that when I cover this, I get to see, you know, the head and the heart converge. But for those brave protesters, first and foremost, my hat's off to you. Stay safe. You know, continue to demand what is your right, what was the right of your ancestors, what people in your country for over a century have been protesting for and been denied through different iterations of authoritarianism and a lot of other foreign and security policy crises. And in short, you are on the side of the right. Again, there's nothing more than I can say that other than I'm doing everything I can as a young 32-year-old first-generation Iranian-American to amplify your voice. You know, I'm someone without social media, and yet I still see all these different videos. But please know our thoughts and prayers are with you, and I know that thoughts and prayers are not enough, and that's precisely why I chose to come on the podcast today, and it's precisely why I'm lucky to be able to do what I do here in Washington. You know, I'm just an Iran watcher. At best, we're footnotes to history. The people making history are you guys on the streets, brave women, brave men, brave, even, you know, beyond the class spectrum, beyond the age spectrum, brave workers, people striking now, not just in educational institutions, but some in the service sector. So first and foremost, my hat's off to you. We hear you. We're trying to amplify your voice. And we simply know that, to borrow a phrase again from 1968, the whole world is watching. Please know the whole world is watching, but the whole world can afford to do a hell of a lot more. So Godspeed to you.
Yeah, we certainly can do a lot more. And, you know, just to bring it home, because what you said resonates with me deeply, not to compare different tragedies at all, but I didn't realize how similar our lives are. I'm a few years older than you, of course, but, you know, my dad's family, my dad and his parents came out of Hungary just as the Nazis were really beginning to take over Hungary. So he escaped before the Holocaust, or just at the cusp of the Holocaust in Hungary. That is, the Holocaust itself had been going on for quite a while in the rest of Europe, and therefore, of course, before the Hungarian Revolution. But my mom's family and my grandparents left around the time, or right after, I forget, the Hungarian Revolution. So I, too, am a first-generation Jewish American from a totally different conflict. And if you and I can be talking about the Iranian people now and what they're trying to do, I think there's hope for what's going on there. So really appreciate it, Benham, for joining me, sharing your insight, sharing your wisdom. And for those listening, take to heart Benham's words, especially the protesters, that the world is watching, the world is with you. And yes, the world should be doing more, but Let's hope that this podcast will have its impact, together with hopefully other media that now we hope will begin to cover this story more, because it certainly deserves it. Thank you, Benham.
Thank you so much. Pleasure.
Look, folks, a very important, timely piece by Benham. I really appreciate Benham Ben Taliblu joining me. Again, Ben is from the Foundation of Defense of Democracies, where he's a senior fellow. A lot to think about, a lot to see how and if and why we should help the Iranian people in their quest against the murderous Iranian regime. The more time passes since the release of my book this past summer, the more I realize just how relevant the topics in the book, in particular with respect to the Iranian regime, are, not only to the Gulf and Israel, not only to the Gulf area and Israel, on all of the Middle East, but certainly to America and, of course, to Europe. So if you have not picked up a copy of my book, please remember to do so. In the Path of Abraham, you can pick it up on Amazon or wherever you get your books. Until next time, I'm Jason Greenblatt. This is The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.